These teams are working very diligently to try to pull the three companies together in alignment on a gas project.
Governor Parnell pushes his idea for a different gas pipeline project. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, January 19th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, village corporations with land rights near the proposed Susitna Dam want more communication with the Alaska Energy Authority.
Our corporation board, they are getting a little concerned that there's not more direct contact with the villages.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by the statewide BP Teachers of Excellence Program. Nomination forms are available at bpteachers.com. Nominations are due by February 14th. The State of Alaska Department of Revenue reminds you to file online now for your 2012 PFD. Also, paper applications are located in your community. More information at pfd.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by the State of Alaska.
Governor Parnell told reporters this morning there has been no agreement among the CEOs of Exxon, BP, and ConocoPhillips on the gas development questions left hanging after their face-to-face meeting on January 5th. Parnell said he has called each of them and expects decisions. He says he is aware that the companies and state employees are meeting to work out details of his call for formulation of a natural gas development project and settlement of Point Thompson litigation.
I think Alaskans are tired of waiting. I'm tired of waiting. But I also will give them credit in the sense that I know from hearing from both my people at the Department of Natural Resources as well as the company's executives that these teams are working very diligently to try to pull the three companies together in alignment on a gas project.
Parnell insists that any new development needs to happen within the framework of AGIA, the Alaska Gas Line Inducement Act. He says the AGIA legal structure protects the state's interests if a project were to develop. He does recognize that all three companies initially rejected participation in AGIA. ConocoPhillips and BP have abandoned their competing project. He was asked what he heard from the companies that gives him encouragement that they have changed their minds.
I think that's a better question to ask them, but I will tell you that the state of Alaska views the protections of the Alaska Gas Line Inducement Act as significant, and Exxon thought them workable enough to come alongside TransCanada, and if the largest oil company, gas company in the world, thinks that they can work with the framework, they're not under the framework at this point, but thinks they can work with it, I don't see a reason why the other two companies might not as well.
Parnell also said that markets have changed from the time when the original offerings were made to potential AGIA shippers. He says the original offers were focused on developing gas to North American markets, but the focus now is on exporting liquefied natural gas to the Pacific Rim.
Time and economics appear to have moved, which is why I've asked these companies to take a serious, hard look at LNG.
Parnell said this morning that the most important element to bringing the companies into alignment over any gas project is resolution of the litigation at Point Thompson. He says the gas from Point Thompson fields is essential to filling the pipeline. Parnell also today made his first public comment on the resignation of controversial state wildlife official Corey Rossi. Parnell said he agreed with Fish and Game Commissioner Cora Campbell's decision to keep Rossi on the job, even after she learned that he was questioned as part of a criminal investigation.
Each case is going to be different, and who knew what when and all that. So my view is that when a person is charged with a crime that directly relates to their job, they need to be removed. Anything short of that is dependent on a case-by-case basis.
Rossi was charged last week with 12 misdemeanor counts related to an illegal black bear hunt that took place in June 2008. Prosecutors say he lied on state hunting reports to cover up who shot three of the four bears killed in the hunt. Parnell and Commissioner Campbell say they knew that Rossi was to be interviewed, but did not know the nature of the investigation until the charges became public. Rossi was director of the State Division of Wildlife Conservation. His lack of qualifications and advocacy of controversial predator control policies made him a divisive figure within the Department of Fish and Game. The proposed Susitna-Watonna Dam project is moving forward. The Alaska Energy Authority, which is planning to build the huge hydroelectric facility, has filed paperwork with the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, which, if approved, puts the project on a timeline for completion in about 6 years. Some Alaska Native village corporations in the Cook Inlet area have land holdings near the dam site, and they are becoming concerned that AEA is not addressing their claims before pushing ahead with construction plans. KSKA's Ellen Lockyer has more.
The land issue goes back 40 years to the signing of the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act. Cook Inlet Region Incorporated is the major landholder in the proposed Susitna-Watonna Dam area. Although much of the land Siri holds will be conveyed to four village corporations in Siri's region, Ethan Schutt is Siri Vice President of Lands Management. Schutt says it's a complicated arrangement.
So we have this land, and for a variety of historical reasons, not all of it has been conveyed to the respective village corporations, but at some point it will be.
Most Siri lands are in populated areas, so there is not much open land for the village corporations to choose from to take their ANCSA selections. Cook Inlet villages are required to select priority lands near home before selecting from two other units in West Cook Inlet and in the Talkeetna Mountains. Some Siri village corporations, like Ninilchik Native Corporation, are still owed lands. Bruce Oskoloff is Ninilchik's Director of Lands and Resources. He says Ninilchik is waiting for lands the corporation is entitled to under ANCSA.
So the village corporations that still have remaining entitlements really, on one hand, just don't have a choice.
Oskoloff says since Ninilchik did not get all the land it was entitled to in its priority selections, the village has a land deficiency and has taken its case to the courts. When the legal wrangling is over, Ninilchik and three other village corporations will be selecting land from the dam area. Although land title in the dam area is not clear yet, Oskoloff says it's not too soon to discuss compensation. Oskoloff says Ninilchik wants to hear more from AEA now.
Our corporation board has taken this issue under consideration. They are getting a little concerned that there's not more direct contact with the villages.
Ethan Schutt, too, says AEA has not asked Siri's opinion on the dam project. Schutt worries that a massive hydroelectric project will no doubt impact Siri energy projects, such as its power-producing Fire Island wind farm. He says AEA is in negotiations with Siri on permits for land and water studies, but Schutt says there is still a lot of discussion that needs to be done, for instance, about archaeological sites or compensation for subsurface mineral rights lost if land is submerged under the dam's reservoir.
It is a mineral prospective region around this proposed Susitna dam site. It's not clear what, if any, impact or what, if any, resources might be in the area.
But AEA's Wayne Dyock, Susitna-Watonna project manager, agrees there are a lot of discussions yet to take place. Dyock says there are work groups scheduled for later this month on the licensing process.
We have not gotten into those discussions with the Alaska Native groups that own those lands at this point in time. Those will be discussions that will take place later.
Dyock says he's doing all he can to keep in touch.
The Alaska Energy Authority recognizes the need and importance for engaging the landowners in discussions. We have initiated those discussions, and we plan to continue them as the licensing process unfolds. So far, we've met with the presidents of Siri, Otnatayonik, Ninilchik Natives Association, and the chief executive officer of Kinikotnu.
Dyock says we are trying to get a better understanding of the various issues that participants have while fleshing out a study plan. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
The Coast Guard cutter Healy and Russian tanker Renda will begin icebreaking operations tomorrow morning in preparation for their outbound journey from Nome. Greg Talapa, the executive officer of the Healy, says the Renda has been taking on water and provisions today. Tomorrow at 9 a.m., he says the Healy will begin warming its engines and coordinating with a helicopter reconnaissance to chart a south by southeast path away from Nome. But they'll first have to dislodge the Renda from the ice.
We'll likely run a couple racetrack patterns or, you know, just big ovals close aboard to Renda. And with the north wind, hopeful that Renda will get dislodged out of its frozen-in status.
If that doesn't work, Talapa says, there are other methods to free the renda.
We'll have to do some what's known as a herringbone maneuver, which is you basically come in perpendicular to the ship and see if you can't break up the ice that's formed on the south side of the renda, and just slowly but surely get it moving. The variability in the ice conditions will really dictate what happens.
Talapa says it's difficult to know exactly how frozen in place the renda is, but he's confident the Healy will be able to provide the relief needed to free the tanker and begin carving a path south to the ice edge nearly 400 miles away. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a Sitka man has an unexpected meeting with a high school classmate in Afghanistan.
What Joe told me when I am 20 years old, I could have gone to college, but I wanted to serve in the Army.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Doyon Limited, Interior Alaska's regional native corporation, providing oil field services, government contracting, and natural resource development in Alaska and across the nation. Information at doyon.com. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. And by Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, stocking a variety of tire chains from passenger vehicles to heavy equipment. On the web at arcticwirerope.com.
A federal judge has upheld the National Marine Fisheries Service decision to restrict fishing in the Western Aleutians in order to protect an endangered stock of marine mammals. The decision is the product of a year-long litigation process in which the state of Alaska, industry groups, and Aleut Enterprise sued NIMFS over their efforts to stop the decline of the Stellar sea lion population. They say that the closures of the Atka mackerel and Pacific cod fisheries are estimated to cost the industry more than $80 million annually, and that NIMFS science doesn't justify the restrictions. The plaintiffs also argued that NIMFS failed to adequately consult the public in the process. In his opinion, Judge Timothy Burgess stated that he sympathized with plaintiffs, but that ultimately, judges are not scientists, and the court had to defer to NIMFS technical expertise. However, the court did conclude that NIMFS was in violation of the National Environmental Policy Act by failing to prepare an environmental impact statement and provide the public with a sufficient opportunity to weigh in on its decision-making process. As a result, Judge Burgess has ordered NIMFS to draft an environmental impact statement, but without vacating their final rule. Attorney for the Freezer Longline Coalition, Ryan Steen, says his clients are happy Judge Burgess concluded NIMFS did not fulfill its obligation to prepare an environmental impact statement, but he says they're disappointed with the other findings.
At this point, we're just considering evaluating the judge's analysis and reasoning on those claims, and what our potential options are for an appeal to the Ninth Circuit.
Alaska Assistant Attorney General Brad Meehan agreed with Steen. Attorneys for the National Marine Fisheries Service could not offer comment at this time. Angoon's Native Village Corporation is petitioning the federal government to take control of a major salmon fishery in southeast Alaska. Kootsnawoo Incorporated says state management has favored the commercial seine fleet over the needs of subsistence users in the Western Admiralty Island community, and the corporation wants the federal government to assert authority over marine waters. That's never been done before in Alaska, but the Federal Subsistence Board will consider the issue this spring. As KFSK's Matt Lichtenstein reports, the results could have broad implications.
Our concern was really born out of what was a shortage of fish for the people in Angoon.
Peter Narrows is general manager for Kootsnawoo, which originally filed its petition with the federal government last May. It claims the state has failed to manage for the subsistence priority required under federal law and instead given the preference to the commercial seine harvest in the Chatham Strait area in order to provide for conservation and subsistence needs. The petition requests that the U.S. Secretary of Agriculture assert a power known as extraterritorial jurisdiction to stop or limit state-managed commercial salmon fisheries in Chatham Strait and adjacent Icy and Peril Straits in June, July, and half of August. Narrows says Kootsnawoo wants an active management plan that recognizes subsistence law and acknowledges the needs of the people in Angoon.
What we would like to do is, you know, is to see, you know, the community prosper just like every other community in Southeast, based on the resources close to them. I mean, I hate to use this phrase, but it's really managing for abundance. So I think, you know, to say that we're looking to close a commercial effort, you know, on a wholesale basis is more of an overstatement than what our intent is. Our intent is to find what the management tools out there and to utilize them.
Saners in Chatham mainly target pink salmon in late July and August, but they also catch what the state calls an incidental take of sockeye. The petition claims a broad overlap between seining and sockeye migrations through Chatham. It raises concerns about several area streams, but it's focused on returns to Canal Coup Lake, which is the closest to Angoon on Western Admiralty Island. Angoon residents have been frustrated by a strict bag limit that narrows calls ridiculously low.
And there is no limit on the amount of fish that the commercial fishermen can catch. So that's really the fundamental problem. Is when you have a limit or bag limit of 15 fish per year per household, you're not meeting the needs of the resident user, the rural user there.
We're very committed to providing for subsistence, and in this particular instance, we recognize that there are some challenges that are involved.
That's Fish and Game Deputy Commissioner Dave Bedford, who says the state is looking at ways to address the concerns over Canal Coup, like making it easier for fish to get up waterfalls. But he says it's hard to see how federal management and more limits on the commercial fishery would have a meaningful impact. He emphasizes that the seine fleet's already restricted by timing as well as the complete closure of certain sockeye migration areas like Mitchell Bay just outside Canal Coup.
The opening of the purse seine fishery in Chatham Straits, generally speaking, doesn't begin to really accelerate until later in the month of July. And the figures that I've seen show that most of the subsistence harvest has taken place by the time we have the first opening of the purse seine fishery in any proximity to Mitchell Bay. So I think that the timing of the fishery in and of itself is offset from the migratory timing of that particular stock.
As a matter of policy, Bedford says the department would not support an extension of federal jurisdiction into state waters. The Chatham Strait area is a major part of the state's seine fishery, and Bedford says the implications of a federal closure would be profound. Right now, the Federal Office of Subsistence Management in Anchorage is working on a staff analysis of the issue. That's expected to come out in time for the Southeast Regional Subsistence Advisory Council to discuss it and listen to public comments during a meeting in Juneau the week of March 19th. Forest Service subsistence biologist and council advisor Cal Cassipit says the Federal Subsistence Board is slated to meet in Juneau right after that to come up with a recommendation for the Secretary of Agriculture. In Petersburg, I'm Matt Lichtenstein.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Wells Fargo, providing Alaskans steps to help reach their financial goals. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A. 8 hours after you quit smoking, your blood oxygen level returns to normal. In 3 months, your lung function improves up to 30%. And 10 years after you quit, your risk of dying from lung cancer is about half that of a smoker. But right now, you're one cigarette closer to cancer. Every cigarette makes you sick. So quit smoking today. Information at 1-800-QUIT-NOW. Or AlaskaQuitline.com. This message sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Quitline.
A pair of recent Sitka High graduates had an unexpected meeting last week in a combat hospital in Kandahar, Afghanistan. J.R. Anchetta is studying photojournalism at the University of Alaska Fairbanks, where he's been working on an extended project with the 125th Stryker Brigade. Anchetta was invited to visit the brigade in Afghanistan last December to cover its activities. As part of his work, Anchetta also visited a combat hospital that has become famous for saving soldiers' lives. KCAW's Robert Woolsey has the story on what happened next.
Every one of us has small world moments when we meet an acquaintance or a friend of a friend in a faraway place. J.R. Anchetta graduated from Sitka High in 2006. If he had known it was Joe Mill, class of 2009, lying behind the curtain in the intensive care area of the Roll 3 International Medical Unit, he may have had second thoughts about going in. He was already having second thoughts about going in.
Would it be somebody I know from the brigade that we've been following? And if I do know this person or these two people, how will I carry myself, or how can I prepare myself to do deal with that situation.
His instructor at UAF and colleague in this documentary project, Cheryl Hatch, had already gone inside to get the soldiers' permission to visit. There was nothing to stop Anchetta but his own fears.
Took a deep breath and prayed, and I decided to join Cheryl because I was kind of getting nervous, and the more time I waited, the more uneasy I felt. So I set my cameras down and went inside and introduced myself to PFC Rex Tharp next to Cheryl, and they were both talking, and I told him I was from Sitka, Alaska, and he said, "Oh yeah, my buddy next to me is from Alaska." And so I turned and I recognized Joe, and he recognized me, and after that, you know, I went next to him and talked to him.
Joe Mill and Tharp are not in Fort Wainwright's Stryker Brigade. They are from Fort Drum, New York. Although Mill was 3 years behind Anchetta in school, the pair knew each other from church in Sitka. Mill's father was stationed in Sitka with the U.S. Coast Guard at the time. Both soldiers had lost their right legs below the knee to Taliban bombs called IEDs, or improvised explosive devices. Mill told Anchetta how it happened.
The two soldiers were on a mission, on a patrol. So PFC Rex Tharp was first injured in a blast in Kandahar. And he first hit the IED. And Specialist Joe Mill, you know, heard the blast and went running to get him, to aid him, and which set off another IED, which they were saying it appeared to be a command wire IED.
The command wire IED in this case was a secondary weapon designed to inflict further damage in an attack, often on those there to render aid. Along with traumatic head injuries, the loss of limbs has become a defining characteristic of wounds suffered in America's wars in the Mideast. Anchetta says his former classmate seemed undeterred.
And he was very concerned about his career in the military because of his leg. And he was constantly asking the nurses, you know, "I don't care if I push buttons, I want to stay in the Army."
But Anchetta says that Mill was also thoughtful about his situation. He asked Anchetta to get in touch with his girlfriend, Hillary Martin, who still lives in Sitka. He also wanted those of us back here to know that the decision to serve should not be taken lightly.
What Joe told me was, "I am 20 years old. I could have gone to college, but I wanted to serve in the Army. And I'm not sure how explicit I could be, but he said, when you go back home, tell people that this stuff is real."
Joe Mill and PFC Tharp were expected to be transferred to a military hospital in Germany. J.R. Anchetta is returning to Alaska for the spring semester at UAF, where he'll also serve an internship at the Fairbanks Daily News Miner. His month-long study in Afghanistan may have delivered a bigger lesson than he bargained for. This stuff and the people who serve are very real.
I think the most touching thing that I've seen here is, you know, the sacrifice that the soldiers give. And I've met a lot of, you know, down-to-earth, awesome young men. And the most amazing thing is just, you know, talking to them.
Reporting in Sitka with help from Jeff Seifert, I'm Robert Woolsey.
The Elkhan 200 Snow Machine Race is this weekend in southeast Alaska. The 43rd annual event takes over the Haines Highway from the Canada to the U.S. border to Yukon's Dej Dash Lake on Saturday as riders and their support teams from around Alaska and Canada race for a prize pot of thousands of dollars. Tara Bicknell has more from KHNS in Haines.
Last year's Elkhan 200 was one of the slowest in its decades-long history. That's because there was hardly any snow or ice covering the paved race course that runs about 160 miles from the U.S.-Canada border to a lake in the Yukon and back. This year is looking to be a reversal, says Rick Campbell, a former racer who's working behind the scenes as a sled mechanic this year.
The thing about every year, it's different every year, but last year, of course, it was pretty dry and lots of wind, and we're hoping not this year, but when I came up, it was looking really good. But then, of course, the temperatures dropped here in the last week. So there was a few bare spots, but nothing like last year. And hopefully there will be no wind, because that's the, you know, the bare pavement and the wind are your two killers.
Snow machiners, unlike vehicle motorists, generally prefer packed snow or ice for race day. It was conditions of that description that partially led to the record average speed for the race, 120 miles per hour, set by Fairbanks' Craig Hill in 2007.
If the road stays the way I saw it, it's quite possible the record could be broken this year.
By midday this Wednesday, 12 riders had pre-registered, which race organizer Karen Hess estimates will be about a third of the total turnout. The lineup for this weekend's race includes last year's overall race winner, Jared Davey of Whitehorse, who's returning to race the same 2008 Yamaha Apex he rode in 2011. But the list of local riders from Haines is slim, says Hess. But she says that could change when nearby residents learn about this year's prize for the first Haines racer to cross the finish line.
$1,500 for the fastest local this year to finish.
The bulk of that prize was donated in honor of one former racer, Haines Dennis Miles, who passed away last winter from an apparent heart attack while skiing on Mosquito Lake. A newly added prize this year may also encourage new riders to enter the race. It again is in memory of a former racer and is called the Rookie of the Year Award.
And that's got to be somebody who's never raced the Alcan before. You know, so if you say you have five people who have never raced before, first one that finishes of those rookies gets $1,000. And then if they want to come back the next year, then the club will waive their entry fee for the following years. That money is being donated by Lila Young. Her and her husband have raced for years, Ron and Lila Young from Cantwell, Alaska. And Ron passed away last spring of pancreatic cancer.
First overall winner is guaranteed at least $1,000 in prize money, with second and third place also guaranteed smaller amounts. This year's Alcan 200 is Saturday, January 21st, along the Haines Highway. Reporting in Haines, I'm Tara Bicknell.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Casey Kelly in Juneau, Ellen Lockyer in Anchorage, Stephanie Joyce and Alexandra Gutierrez in Unalaska, Matthew Smith in Nome, Matt Lichtenstein in Petersburg, Robert Woolsey in Sitka, and Tara Bicknell in Haines. APRN's Dave Donaldson reported from Juneau. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station. Timing is everything. A mother who waits until her child is at least 2 years old before becoming pregnant again has a better chance of regaining strength and energy between pregnancies. Her baby is more likely to be born on time and at a good weight. So talk to your health care provider to find out how to plan your pregnancies and ask for the state's free birth spacing booklet. Take the time to build a strong and healthy family. This message sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services. Every Alaskan can make a difference when we file online for our PFD. You can shelter families in crisis, nourish the hungry and homeless, and protect those who have suffered abuse and neglect. And it's easy to share a little of your PFD through Pick, Click, Give. And good things will happen for the causes you care about. This message sponsored by Atwood Foundation and Alaska Children's Trust.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.